You were talking about the editorial in the Santa Ana Register of today, August 8th, is that correct?
Yes.
And what was the name of the editorial?
Oh, it's called the Mass Movements in the Government.
Mass Movements in Government.
It points out that nearly everybody who wants to get anything talks about getting it from the government. If they want to get it for a lot of people, whom they often call the underprivileged, then they try to get privileges for those people through the government at the expense of other persons. And to get this, they try to cultivate and develop mass sentiments and thereby mass voting so that the government can be employed for the special purpose of benefiting a large number of people at the expense of a smaller number who are supposed to be less deserving of the relative prosperity which this smaller number enjoys.
Is that what this article is about? Is that what you're
saying? Yes, that's what it's about. Of course, it contrasts this procedure on the part of person seeking public office and to continue holding public office with the action of a small minority of the persons who are producing the wealth and values of the country. Points out how, especially a decade or two or three ago, this minority of businessmen were seeking special privileges for themselves at the expense of others whom they thought were their competitors or more or less inimical to their own prosperity, foreigners and the like. And so they sought the aid of the politicians to get special privileges for themselves, such as tariffs, monopolies of various kinds, and special privileges of a great variety. He points out how that had turned out ill, because the persons who are really most productive are the minority persons, the ones who have leadership, executive, creative capacity, organizational powers. And that these persons, always being in the minority, can always be outvoted by persons of a less gifted nature. So they're therefore always bound to lose because they can never command the voting strength. That is to say, they lose when they proceed on the basis of what this editorial calls mass movements and government. The writer very truly points out how both parties, both procedures, whether carried on by demagogues for the benefit of masses or carried on by narrow and short-sighted businessmen for the benefit of them of their particular selves, and both are bound to fail because getting action through government is illegitimate in nature. It is always getting the action benefits for some at the expense of others, because government itself can never function in any degree except through the energy which it derives from seizing property against the will of those who produce it and infringing their liberties and frequently sending their sons to wars. Since all governments rest on this foundation, therefore no mass action, whether on the part of the left, so-called, or of the right, so-called, can result in anything but frustration and disappointment, the very opposite of what they desire.
All right, so what is your alternative?
This article, it seems to imply that there should be an alternative in nature, and of course there is. But the natural things, the things that work and operate and do not cause distress and disease, anxieties and turbulence, these things don't make the headlines. They're not so conspicuous, not so obvious. What is the basis of civilization is the things that men do for one another and not against one another. And it's the preponderance of these things, of this kind of behavior, is what gives us the human life and its advancing character in the world. This behavior is what has to be looked into. We don't have to look far. We find it is very old. We find it set out most explicitly in the New Testament, but it's in all the moral codes, both Old and New Testament, Christian and non-Christian. It is these things by which the life of mankind is sustained. So the mutual relations existing between one and another without dominance or subservience on either side. This relationship, as seen in our economic system and from a purely legal point of view, is usually called the contract relationship, a resolution of people's combined will and mind, the meeting of their minds towards a given result. And by this joining, coming together as one of men's minds, then the creation of wealth and values and the advancement of life is obtained.
Well, can you quote or read a few sentences in this editorial that you think might point out an alternative?
No, I cannot. That's what strikes me, that this writer can so well realize that the futility of both procedures of getting mass action on behalf of either one party or the other being completely futile, and yet he doesn't suggest any specific alternative to this. I'm glad to point out that that alternative exists, and that we practice it so quietly and so successfully, and that we haven't given it much attention, although all our advance toward the more abundant life in this world, and perhaps also in the next, has come from just this kind of procedures. These procedures in freedom, without dominance or subservience on either side. So that the actions of men under this state of freedom is called free enterprise, because they carry on enterprises in which neither party dominates or rules the other side, the other party. They're free with respect to one another. That does not mean, however, that they are free from external infringements, from sources that are not involved in the contract relation itself, that is to say, the source of rulership, governance, slavery, and even death. So I would wish to see this writer and others who have so far advanced as to the, in the negative point of view, that they could see this positive alternative that is around us, above us, and beyond and below us, sustaining our civilized existence, and realize that this is where we must look for all our truly legitimate heart's desires. In order to be of service to one another, we must make commitments to do so. And such commitments, if not forced by either side, infringing the liberties of the other, are always of a nature of contract. And the contract is a commitment, an engagement to do mutual good. Now, to do mutual good to one another, men must have not only their bodies, hands, and feet, they must have instruments, tools, so to speak. They must have materials and instruments for serving one another. All such tools and services, instrumentalities, I should say, have to come within the category of what we call property. Because it is only by the aid of such accessory material things that we can be of any great aid to one another. What makes property important is that it is the subject matter of contract, without which contract cannot be made effective. And it must therefore consist in the sole jurisdiction of him to whom it belongs, in order that he may use it exclusively or dominantly in the interest of the other party to the contract. So property, looked upon as the necessary instrument in order that we may serve one another, in order that we may love one another by serving one another, the only kind of loving which accomplishes anything in the practical way, in order that this may happen, we must have the sacredness of contract sacredness of property and the inviolability of contract. Our own Constitution provides for the inviolability of the contract relation between men. Although the way in which the Constitution is maintained, or supposed to be maintained and followed by our public authority, is one which at the very beginning must violate the contract principle. Well, all things come about by stages, steps, and by degrees. And so the socializing of the world, the advancement of society, has to come about by various stages. Now, there are two kinds of properties which men must use in serving one another. There are those which produce goods and services that are peculiar and special to the individual, which they can have separately from one another, commonly called private property. There are others, other kinds of goods and services men must have in order that they may have this private relationship. There are goods and services they must have in common with one another, which men cannot have otherwise or separately. And when it comes to this whole field of common public property, this has not been socialized in the proper sense of the word. This private property, this public property, this properties in common, like a common police service, common transportation, common water supply, all of these things which we must have in common are left under the jurisdiction of persons who do not relate themselves to others by contract, but relate themselves by violence, namely the personnel of governments. So we're in a way only half civilized. When it comes to private goods and services, we confer them upon one another by the divine process, the creative process or contract. But when it comes to our common goods and services, which we cannot have separately from one another, they're still relegated to the administration of the man on horseback or his duly elected successors. And here's where we're vainly striving to get good out of evil, to use illegitimate means to obtain, vainly trying to obtain what we consider and what are in fact legitimate ends. Now, the basic property is what we call land and natural resources. And when this is administered by the contract process, it will serve men. And is administered otherwise, then it leaves men exposed to slavery and degradation. And the great sign of our present time is that nature is giving us, evolving, or God is conferring upon us, a new technique with respect to property and land. He's using this as a means of freeing us from the dominance of the powers and principalities of the world. This institution of property and land is coming to be a great service institution because it's being gathered in large quantities and being administered by corporate owners on a self-sustaining basis. And wherever this occurs, we have men acting in without restraints and coercions upon one another, acting in freedom, and in freedom vastly more productive. I need only point out that in the past decade, there have been organized and are successfully operated thousands and thousands of small communities in which there's a unified ownership, in which all the inhabitants are there under a contractual relationship called lease between them and the single ownership. Now, these communities are making money for all concerned. That's why they're growing in number. One class of them is called shopping centers. Others are called industrial cities or towns. Some are called real estate complexes. Some are called garden cities. Some are called industrial communities. And there, underlying it all and running through it all, is the hotel type of administration, in which the single proprietor is conferring common services, public services, upon all the inhabitants, upon no relationship except the contract which exists between the inhabitants of the property and those who own and administer it for their benefit and for their recompense, which comes from the benefit so given. This process is making money for all parties concerned, and the reason that it's so doing is increasing, and it only has to go on far enough until it will take over all of the public services, for health is always more catching than disease. Profit is more serviceable, more pursued than loss, and life is ever more dominant over death. Health is more catching than disease. Life always more powerful than death.
Would you like to hear what you said?
No, I don't know. I said it so poorly in most respects.
I don't think you do.
But I can see myself blundering as I went along. I hated it.
Well,
it could be said
thinking,
so much better.
You're thinking out loud. That, I mean, after all, everybody can't do that.
But there's certain self-consciousness that I'm doing. If I can just do it without having to think about how it sounds at all, just do it because it comes out of itself, then it takes much better form.
Like Chauncey Depew?
I guess so.
When they introduced him, so and so.
All through here. If I had heard somebody else, even Ron Reg Wood, I'd be sort of wincing all the time. Now, if I hear it myself, if I hear it now, I'm going to wince. That could have been done so much better. Even if it doesn't have any mispronunciations or anything like that in it, when it comes back to me, it'll have hissing and blundering and humming and awing. And
why? I don't think it will.
And I hate all of that stuff.
I think that your enunciation is, I think your voice is perfect for recording.
You must hear it when it's spontaneous, when I'm not distracted by any thought of anything but the thing I'm thinking about, and getting it across to another person's, other people's mind, feeling they're getting it.
Okay, what about this book you've been reading and these notes you were writing that you started to tell me about?
Well, I thought of those notes, and I could recast them in my mind some time before I wrote them down, and I wrote them down and rubbed out some and got them in better shape. And I'm going to do it furthermore. I haven't put them in permanent shape.
You know what a very interesting experiment is? To take a subject like that book.
You're running tape now, aren't you?
Yes, and see how you talk about it. And then see how you write about it. It's a very interesting thing. I've worked this out with people. You can take a subject. When you start to write anyone, I say you, I mean anybody, they write it one way, they talk it another, and sometimes they think it another, the same person. Or they'll say it over the phone different way, or they'll say it in a different way to different people. The same subject.
I'll tell you what I've been reading and making some brief notes about. I've been rereading a book that was famous in my youth.
There it is, right under the newspaper. Right,
a book written by a famous German scientist, contemporary of Darwin, at a time when there was so much conflict between the ideas of theology and materialistic science. This author's Ernest Haeckel, and the book is called The Riddle of the Universe.
Riddle of the Universe, when was it published, do you know?
All published about the time, shortly after Darwin, which would be in about the third quarter of the 19th century.
How do you spell his name, Haeckel?
H-A-E-C-K-E-L, Haeckel, Ernest Haeckel.
Haeckel. Is he still living?
He is probably the most forceful exponent of scientific materialism of his time. A very wonderful writer, a wonderful scientist, and a wonderful thinker, but very much opposed and antagonistic to the Christian theology, which was so much out of harmony at that time, at least, with the findings of the physical and natural sciences. So in reading the last part of his book, rereading it, he lays it down that we must abandon what he calls Christian superstition and all those things, even including the idea of a personal God. But he recognizes that human nature calls for some kind of religion. And he proposes what he calls scientific monism, or the monistic philosophy. In this he denies man having free will. He denies everything that people have commonly characterized as spiritual as distinguished from material. And he even rather ridicules some of the most cherished conceptions of our Christian civilization. But if we may accept all his denials and all his negations, there still remains questions to be asked. We may say to him and to those who think with him, accepting your general statement, then, to me. No inspiration of beauty. Let me go back a moment. He summarized on the positive side that his monistic philosophy has three goddesses. He names them. He says, we shall replace the triple deity of Rome by three monistic goddesses, truth, virtue, and beauty. But in describing these three, he uses nothing but the vaguest abstractions. He does not give us any concrete examples. He doesn't give us any behavior which is characteristically either true, virtuous, or beautiful. So he hands us another set of abstractions, which I think might be open to the same criticism that he gives us to what he calls our spiritual conceptions. Passing that, however, there appears to be in his monistic philosophy, or monistic religion, great lack. No inspiration of beauty, no ecstatic vision beyond our present bodily limitations as to space and time. No ever ongoing manifestation of creative spirit in the phenomenal world. No continuous objective. No continuous No continuous objectification of the subjective dream, the purpose, and the design. No human and divine self-realization. No creative dominion for man. No transforming. Who got that? No creative dominion for man. With little or none of these conceptions included in his monistic philosophy, it would seem to be as static as a dead world. Let us realize that the present century has a great deal to add to the finest scientific thinking of the 19th. Let us hope that this century will not default on the great opportunities that it has. Period. Let's stop it.
All right, what did you think about the headlines this morning? We're going to the moon by 1970, and Congress has appropriated the money to send a man to the moon.
Well, until it is done, and certainly the Russians have done something in that direction, until it is done, it isn't anything but moonshine.
Okay.
After it's done, then it's time to talk about it. It's time to bluster and blow, pretend. Until then, I think we can do much better if we wouldn't try to just follow in the wake of somebody else. If we go forward, then somebody else can follow us. But while we follow them, they always have the lead. I remember children used to say, get some child to imitate something they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And when the child would hesitate, they'd say, look at me, do as I do. And the child did this. And then they would say to the child, monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah.
So we look at the Russians and the Russian government, and we monkey see. Then when we see something, then we have to monkey do. And that seems to be our foreign policy.
But didn't we have our ideas about all these things on time before Russia was having our scientists?
Well, whoever had ideas when it comes to these purely material things, Russia certainly has objectified the ideas, made its dreams come true so far. We have been doing this, making dreams come true too, not through our government, because we've been making the creative dream come true through creating things while governments destroy. We should rest upon our own laurels. We have glories behind us and glories to come. But since we are not able to appraise the spiritual side of our civilization, we must follow in the trail of the crass materialists who would dominate the world in the same way as Alexander, Caesar, Napoleon, Hitler, and whoever has the reins of power in the present age.
All right, so what do we do about it?
We act either as animals do, a dumb-driven cattle or fierce beasts, on the one hand, or we act creatively, take the situation and build our dreams into our world. And this we can only do through understanding things. The greatest need is understanding. With all thy gettings, yet understanding.
All right, how do you start understanding them now? Let's start understanding.
A very important question, and the way to understand things is first is to have faith. And I mean it.
Faith
I mean it literally. I'll tell you in what we must have faith literally. In the universe. God, if you like, if God is everything. We must believe that this universe is a cosmos, that it can be understood, and not a chaos which could not be understood. It has a rational quality about it, a divine quality about it, which is capable of serving us. And if we fail to believe that, to have that faith, we will not pursue knowledge. We will not pursue understanding. And without knowledge, without understanding, we're creatures on the face of nature, subject to whatever nature imposes. But when we have inspiration, the faith of inspiration, that things can be understood, that they are beautiful in essence, and the beauty can be discovered, when we have that faith, then we proceed to have scientific and all other kinds of knowledge, artistic, intuitional as well as rational knowledge. So that what we need above all things is the faith, the inspiration of the beauty and rationality of the universe. We must have that faith before we will turn a hand towards accomplishing even the understanding, much less the actual fact.
All right, now, let's take an engineer, and he's working out some engineering problem which is completely and wholly undiscovered as yet. And he has his drafting board, and he has all of his formulas for this engineering problem. Now, does he have to have faith in his instructor, in his formula, or in his own ability to work this thing out himself? Now, where is your faith placed? Where is the faith placed?
Wherever we place our attention and give our energies, that is the way we express our faith.
All right, in life? And let's say we have no faith in the way things are today. We have no faith in our politicians that we send to Congress or to Washington. We have no faith in their ability to carry out our desires. We have no faith in our fellow man. So maybe a lot of this is our fault. Maybe we say, oh, I'm just sending another grafter to, because I voted for him, and now he's no different than anybody else. He's a big crook like all the politicians are, and there's nothing I knew about anyway, so one's just as good as the other, or just as bad as the other, and I've got things to do. And
there is no action without motivation. And there are two kinds of motivation and two kinds of action. There are those things which are imposed upon us by necessity, to which we are bound, and there are those things which we do spontaneously under inspiration. The whole animal world is a world of necessity, and the animal part of man responds to the necessities of his environment, to what his environment imposes on him. But the human part of man rises beyond that, because the human part of man dreams things and desires things that it's never had before, without which it could live, which it doesn't have to have. And then that kind of motivation causes men to pursue the sciences, pursue the arts, to explore, to develop recreations, to write poetry, and to live their whole inspirational life. And out of that inspirational life comes every good and perfect gift. However, we have an inborn instincts and intuitions of which we're very little, if any, aware. And these things prompt us to act better than we think. And so we're only living today because we acted better than we understood, better than we thought. However, when we learn to understand the rationale of our actions, how it is that we live, not merely how we die, and we learn to understand those things, then we can really become the lords of creation, because we rise out of our animal nature, out of our necessitous world, and move into the world of non-necessity, in the world of creation. We become as God, because we have dreams of things that never were, and then we can create those dreams in the way in which we dreamed them, as God created the world in the image in which he dreamed it. Man is potentially divine, but he's only divine through his being able to imagine things that never were, and to put forth effort to accomplish those things. And in that alone, does he have happiness. As an animal, he may be relieved of pain, but in his creative technology, in his building and creating things that, of which he has only dreamed before, there and there alone does he find his truly human happiness.
now let's get back to this, shall we call it a philosophy, or this comment, or this intellectual observation of life. Now let's go back to when you were a young man working for the government in the patent office. What did you get a year? $1,200 a year?
In the Navy Department for most of that time when I was reading law, my salary was $1,200 a year.
It was $1,200 a year, and you had a...
Latterly it was raised to 15, but I soon gave it up after that.
All right, you had, at that time, 3 children?
Yeah.
And a wife. What year was that about what year?
1901 to 1905.
Do you remember what rent you paid, or did you own your home?
I don't know if I paid rent.
Pay rent. Do you remember what you paid?
No, I don't remember that.
Well, maybe $20 a month. Did you live in Washington or Baltimore, remember?
During the time I was reading law, I lived in that part of Washington which we called Georgetown, the west end of Washington. Occupied a 3 or 4 room apartment on the edge of town.
3 or 4 rooms with 3 children. All right, now, what if at that time someone had said, now here you must have been in your own mind saying to yourself, not just because of your family perhaps, but saying to yourself, now this can't be all that there is to life, just getting up every morning and going on my job and doing it as well as I could and coming home. Now, to whom can I turn? I can't turn to my family always because they get upset. To whom can I turn? If I turn to God and ask God's guidance in my work, or to give me a raise, or to get me a better job or something, to whom do I turn? Now, what if a young man in your position at that time could have turned to someone as you are today, someone with all your desires to serve and your intellect, now what would you tell a young man that would come to you today in your same position, in a relative way, with 3 children and a wife, and whether he couldn't, of course, make $1,200 a year, but comparable to that. Now what could you tell him of your philosophy? What could you tell him?
A young man acquiring a profession today and having family responsibilities and not seeing his way very clear ahead and asking my general advice as to the conduct of his life, I would recommend to him above everything else that he take account of the various items of his circumstances. And in so doing, he should separate those things which he can use for the fulfillment of his desires from those things which are not so serviceable to him. And that while he acknowledged the negative side of his situation, that he, having acknowledged it, then he turned his attention, his practical attention, and give his energies to those things which he discovers are serviceable to his life and to his dreams. The first thing is to separate the useful from that which is not useful, the evil, the good from the evil. And that he have no more concern with those things, the obstacles in his path, than he must have in order to turn his back upon them. And to remember that all his advance in his life towards his dreams, towards his ideals, will consist in the things which he creates and not the things which obstruct him on the road. The time that he spends, the energy which he puts forth in dismissing or in beating down circumstance, in overcoming those things which are inimical to his progress, beyond that which he cannot avoid, all such activity is subtracted from that creative side of his nature, which carries him to his heart's desires.
Well, now in your case, you studied law at night, right?
Mm-hmm.
And was this, did you select law because you had an act and wanted to? Or you chose it because you would like to be in a lawyer? Or did it, was it the easiest and most accessible? Or did you say to yourself, well, now a lawyer is a good paying profession and I can make the grade at it? How did you select? Did you select it because it paid well, or did you select it because you wanted to be a lawyer? I think you had made an excellent doctor. Why didn't you choose medicine rather than law?
The road to medicine was not as accessible. More hurdles, more obstacles, take more time, more costs and everything, not as available, although I did think of it. My own spontaneous interest was primarily in the sciences, and primarily in the natural sciences. I had read a great deal of the natural sciences without studying them in school or college, and I felt that's where my interest lay. And I made some steps towards taking a course of reading in that. And then I realized that I could not expect any material returns from that for a long time, if ever. I did feel that the profession of law was more accessible to me, and that I had talents that would be used to good advantage in that field, which would bring me earlier, if not more abundant, returns than I could expect in anything else at the time. So I gave up my aspirations towards enjoying the reading of science and disposed of some books on that subject to get them out of my way so as to be not to be attracted too much by them, and confined myself during that time rigidly to the study of the law with a view to making a better living in that field than I had been able to make before that.
Well, when you did get your degree, and that was 1905.
That was 2 degrees. That was my
2 degrees.
Master's degree in 1905.
Then, instead of just going into general practice, did you at any time think, well, I should be with a law firm and I should get into general practice? Or what made you made up your mind to go right into patent law and on your own without any partners or anything else? Anyone advise you, or did your wife give you the idea, or was she for it or against it, or was she afraid you were going to starve to death?
She never took any very positive stand in those matters. I can't just remember how I... Oh yes, now it comes to me. During the time that I was studying law, especially in my later years, I took on the piece job by the piece of writing patent specifications for patent agents who were not lawyers, who conducted the mail order business. I took their drawings and drawings and descriptions that received from their clients and wrote up the whole case, sometimes one or two, three cases in an evening, in a very sketchy fashion. That brought me somewhat into the world of patent law, on the edge of it. So I had some knowledge and acquaintance with people in that field that enabled me to set up, not merely as an agent, but as a qualified member of the bar, to practice both before the patent office and every other department of the government, as well as in the courts. And I got the entree to that through having done this sort of hack work for mail order patent agents while I was reading law.
And then when you did resign, how old were you when you got out of the Navy Department? Weren't you in the patent office of the Navy Department?
No.
What were you in the Navy Department?
called the Bureau of Equipment, and it was the Bureau which at that time was establishing coaling depots in various parts of the world for the use of our naval ships, which then used coal as fuel, and had been dependent on borrowing it from the British in different parts of the world, having no stations of their own.
What did you have to do? Just a clerk, or what did you do?
Well, I had to pass a very rigid engineering examination. It was held by the Navy Department using the papers and questions provided by the Civil Service Commission.
Where did
you get I took a competitive examination with some 10 or 12 other candidates, but I was the only one who went through the whole thing. It was a very abstract and very difficult examination, which none of us passed, but I was the one who stuck it through, and so that's perhaps the reason why they had to select me.
Where did you get your engineering knowledge to answer these questions or to take this kind of an examination?
I had a flair for that sort of thing, and I got it out of the handbooks, and while I was acting as a draftsman and machine designer for the Elgin Watch Company.
You taught yourself, sort of?
For the crane company and hydraulic engineering for Western Electric. And I taught myself through first being a draftsman and becoming gradually into becoming a responsible designer, and through studying at nights and all odd times the necessary handbooks and necessary mathematics to qualify myself for engineering work. I began all that, however, before I took up law at all. I began all that by starting an engineering course, mechanical engineering, which I pursued for about a year and a half, got some kind of certificate for it, and then started out on my own as a draftsman. Necessity making this the only thing I could do.
Well, then you would say to a young man, have faith, what, in yourself? And search your soul and mind for creative ability and put that to work, because that is God-given. Is that what you would say to a young man who is seeking all the necessities and accomplishments that you sought, whether his salary today is $10,000 a year or $1,000 a year? He still has these same problems.
In general terms, I'm trying to make it more... I'd say that, but I would try to make it more specific. And say in particular, in your situation at this present moment, write down the different things that you feel that you have within your reach. And I write down on another column or another piece of paper the obstacles which you find are in your road. Now weigh these obstacles carefully. Think how serious they are. And then feel that you have to steer between them, as it were. But now look on your other sheet of paper and see what the opportunities are, the possibilities are. Open and knock on all the doors. It seems as though they might have something behind them for you. And as they open a little, push them further open. Let some light come through and be guided by the light that you see as you proceed. But in no case, try to use up your time and energy discussing the things which you find it impossible to do. The doors that remain closed when you knock, the lions in the way, the things that rise in your path that tend to deter you, give them no more countenance than you're obliged to do.
All right, what if some young man is in the position that you were in a relative way as a young man with his family, and he took this position very seriously, and his only opportunity was to buy in to some firm of some kind, or buy a piece of real estate or something. That would be his one opportunity. and he's hardworking, and he's honest, and he has all these things, make a go of it, but he can't get this land, or he can't get the money together to buy into a company. Say that you'd have to buy into a law firm to get into your business. All right, now what happens to him? Where does he turn? What does he put his faith in now? The bank and the mortgage, or what does he do? Does he eliminate this opportunity that requires money that he doesn't possess? What does he do then?
That situation is not an opportunity. He can't embrace an opportunity which he doesn't have. He can't raise the money. The difficulties he can't overcome, and so he can't embrace an opportunity that isn't within his reach. I tried to embrace a supposed opportunity to open and to establish an automobile business in the year 1900.
Is that that steam?
Yes.
Car?
I didn't succeed, and so when I found the door closed, I gave no more thought to it. I didn't bewail it or complain about it and wear myself out grieving over it. I turned in another direction.
About the steam automobile.
And so your young man you speak of who finds he wants to do something and he hasn't the means and can't obtain the means, and having tried faithfully, then it's time for him to look in some other direction.
But maybe it's the only opportunity.
Not sit down on this lack of opportunity and try to make his life out of what he can't do.
Well, isn't that what we're doing editorially? Isn't that what we're telling ourselves, that we don't have scientists and that Russia's doing this and that, and we don't have this and we don't have that, and we don't have all these things? Are we doing that with our today?
Yes, if we try to follow the Russians, do everything they do, and thereby keep ourselves in the rear of them, behind, where we will then necessarily belong, have to be, we'll never excel them in that manner. We have to, in the home expression, we have to hoe our own row. We have to mark out our own course and pursue it. And because the Russians seem to have many scientists, and we don't seem to have as many as they have, or as competent, then we must rush into manufacturing scientists. Now that's bound to fail. It isn't the number of scientists, how many people get labeled scientists and get diplomas or degrees. It's what people do that counts in the long run. We must have our own objectives, our own aims of what to do, and create for ourselves the means for doing the things which we plan to do, and not to walk in the footsteps of somebody else, whose path is certainly rather a thorny one of itself. If we knew as much about the Russians as we knew about ourselves, we'd probably know that they were having a pretty difficult time getting along in comparative slavery, as we are getting along with a less degrading servitude to our own public authorities.
And aren't we talking about how Johnny can't read, how we're spending all of our money, how our taxes...
All this spending of money, all this propaganda about having more scientists, has to create, we want to create more Johnnies, apparently.
Well...
And that isn't going to get us anywhere.
Isn't that practically all that comes out of any newspaper?
That's all that comes out of any political authority. All governments have never created anything.
Well, but we're...
They've always tried to use the wrong means to create. They've destroyed everything. It's been destroyed. They've been destroyed principally by governments. Almost alone.
We're in a Cold War now. The newspapers tell us we're in a Cold War, and we're this and we're that, and we have to learn how to fight after we have an attack from some missile, and we have to learn to protect ourselves and all this business. So,
what we need is to look after our own prosperity. And the more prosperous we make ourselves, the more powerful we will become. And the more influence we'll have in the world, first as exemplars. And second, if the world cannot follow our creative example and get as rich and powerful as we got in that way during the 19th century, then we will have the means wherewith to defend ourselves in case of attack. All wars are won by the creative process in the long run. They're parasites upon creation because they're destruction. Nothing can be destroyed till after it's created. So So we have to have a great creative economy before we can suffer much loss. And to build that economy is the strongest defense that we can ever have against any of the vicissitudes of the future, be they from other governments or from natural causes or whatnot. We must build our own lives, make our own lives strong, our own economy strong, and not try to follow just in the wake of others. We must be prudent to be sure. And if we find a gun at our back, we must try to wrest it from the hand of the enemy. And if it comes to a choice between his life and mine, I prefer mine. And if I'm the stronger, nature will prefer me, and nature will choose the stronger in that desperate situation. And a situation with which we only rarely come in contact with in this day and age of the world, nearly all of our relations are less tragic than that. And it's in them that we have our make or mar our lives.
Well, all right, you were telling me the other day, I don't know if you recall, about we should do one thing or the other. We should tell Russia or whoever it is to tell Cuba or whoever it is. What was it you said we should say? We should do one thing or the other thing and not just go along and try to keep them happy, that we can't do that. Appeasement and compromise never worked. You were saying just the other day. And we should say, all right, now, let's do it this way, and if you don't want to do it that way, okay, then this is what we'll do. We'll shoot one of our missiles off or whatever it is, and that'll be the end of that.
Well, I say if we're in the arena, and men threaten us like wild beasts, it's necessary for us to defend ourselves, and they have not yet attacked us. If they threaten to do so and are preparing to do so, we draw a line. That's our foreign policy. Cross that line, and it is war. War. And going to be war in no uncertain terms. That's a foreign policy. But if we say we will try to accommodate you, whatever you wish, however much you wish to preparing to trespass upon us, how much you're trying to violate all previous commitments, however you are attempting to upset the peaceful status quo, but as long as we're trying to negotiate with that enemy, he never knows how far he can go, and he's always going a little further, and he always can, and we're always appeasing him. And then at last, we're backed against the wall, and we have to fight in the last desperate situation instead of at the beginning when we're better prepared.
You listened to Pressman and you listened to Fulbright the other night on Foreign Aid, and you listened to Arthur Dean, who heads the nuclear testing apparatus. Do you remember any of those things that they talked about? Did they say anything? Or?
I was completely disgusted with everything I heard on the subject.
All right, why were you completely disgusted?
Because it was all irrational, all shilly-shally, all trimming and trying to, all expediency, when we try to do this and do that. And there was no fundamental stand taken by anybody.
Don't you? What about Barry Goldwater? You listened to him? With Pressman.
He does say, whether he makes it particularly clear just what it would be, that until we do have a definite foreign policy, we don't ourselves know what we're going to do, much less the enemy know what they can depend on us. And what we need, as Barry Goldwater lays it down, is a definite foreign policy, so that we, our own people, know what we're going to do, and the enemy knows what we're going to do. Not that we give away our strategy, but they know how far they can go until we do our damnedest, so to speak. Not that I recommend that we have war, but if we're going to have it, we better have it on our own terms than to be backed in a corner, backed in by them, backed into a blind alley, and then have to fight with our hands behind our backs.
On their terms?
On their terms, yes.
Well, what did Goldwater say?
I don't remember his words, but I think he said in effect about the same thing.
But you didn't like what Pressman said. You didn't like what Fulbright said.
All the negotiators and compromisers and everything like that are just being bluffed into less and less tenable positions.
All right, what would you do if you were in the president's position right now, if you were Kennedy? What would you do right now? We've got Berlin on our hands, and we've got Khrushchev on our hands, and Cuba on our hands.
Frankly, I don't know what I would do. I'd very likely make serious blunders and mistakes. But I know what I'd like to see done. I'd like to see the president something like Grover Cleveland, who knew his own mind and could take a stand. And who said that it's not the business of government to support the people. The government has to be supported by the people. The man who, in foreign policy, I don't remember them. Whoever was the president who dealt with the Algerian pirates when they threatened civilization. Theodore Roosevelt, when some pirates captured a naturalized American and holding him for ransom. Do you think he negotiated? I don't admire him very much, but I admire him from that stand. He knew what he was talking about and was ready to do it and let the world understand it was going to be done. I'm not familiar with his recent Berlin talk. In fact, I have not read any of his speeches, although I've scanned them to some extent. But I'm convinced that it's been a good many years before we've had anybody in public authority who, together with his associates, was looking towards anything but the next election. Nobody can have any firm policy about anything when he's catering to causing votes out of people. And that's what all of our public men, substantially all of
you
them.
You mean the ones that are elected to office through voting?
But there are very few exceptions. Men who are independent of the office, have means and abilities of their own without depending on any public office, and who have high enough ambitions to be able to live a creative life without living upon the taxpayers.
Well, as long as we do pay taxes, somebody has to collect them, somebody has to spend the money. We can't do it individually.
The reason we have no foreign policy is because we have nobody who has any ear to the ground, but what has his ear to the ground with a view to collecting votes, and he caters to the most corrupt gangsters of every kind, respectable and other respect and other than respectable, to get the mass votes wherever they think the votes are more or less clotted so they can be handled in large numbers, be delivered in large numbers. It'd be the personnel, the quality of our public men has so deteriorated under this thing of dependence upon vox populi, depending upon mob sentiment. You've gone so far with that now that our public men have deteriorated as they've deteriorated in all republics who depended upon mass voting to govern who shall use the tax power and the war power.
All right, but here we have this situation. This is what exists now. No one human being can do anything about it. No writer.